It's Nectar Devotion Class, Kartiko 9, number 6, day number 6. And we were discussing, Rupa Goswami is discussing about karma and gyan. We have small notes taken about the defects of non-devotional gyan and vairagya, knowledge and detachment. Some of this is a review of what we already said, because these notes were taken on another time, but I thought they were applicable, so maybe repetitive also. Gyan and material gyan, or Brahma gyan, and vairagya, non-devotional detachment, or non-devotional vairagya, they make the hard heart, whereas bhakti is described as being very soft and tender. If the heart becomes hard, it's difficult for bhakti to enter. It's most important to understand that bhakti is only caused by bhakti itself. Therefore, there's no need for jnana or vairagya. Rather, jnana and vairagya arise from bhakti. It's a very hard and rigorous path to independently attain Brahma jnana. Must deeply study the tattvas in the Vedanta Sutra and perform intense tattva vichara, deep deliberations on all the sutras and aphorisms of Vedanta. And the Vedantic path and the Vairagya path of renunciation is very difficult. Fastings, as I said, stand in the middle of five fires. One, the sun, midday sun overhead, and then fires in four directions. It's very difficult. Unnecessary trouble for the body. In the path of Vairagya, we must tolerate many physical miseries. The path of bhakti does not depend on Vairagya. Prabhupada once said to a new bhakta after 1 week of serving Krishna in the temple, he said, "Look at my new devotees. They're 1 week. They've been 1 week, 7 days in the temple serving, and already they're Brahman realized." because they realize Aham Brahmasmi, that I'm not the body, I'm the eternal servant of Krishna. And this is actually the culmination of Brahma Gyan. I study lots of all these Vedanta sutras and Tattvamasi and Soham and meditate on all these aphorisms and Pranava Omkar, Om, and all this. And finally, yes, there is something. I am more than the body. I exist independently of this body. I exist beyond this body. I'm something eternal. There's some inner eternal. There's some inner unlimited bliss within me that I can tap, that I can realize it, and I'm beginning to understand that that is me. And this comes in very, very slow increments, in very, very mild revelations after difficult study, rigorous study, day and night. And we simply say, "Hey, Prabhu, you're not the body, shave your head." You're not your hair. That hair in your head is stool. Just nails, stool, and hair. It's all contaminated. Just shave off that stool from your head and wash the deity's dishes and pots and pans and cut the vegetables for Sunday feast. You're Krishna's servant. Now serve Krishna. 4 a.m. to 12 p.m. Oh, I'm not the body. I'm not the body. I'm not this body. I'm not this body. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. I'm not this body. I'm Krishna's eternal servant. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Oh, Prabhu, please, temple commander, can I have some service? Oh, you want some service? We have some service for you. So this is, service is devotion. Devotion is love. Devotion is serving. And the object of our service is not some person of the material world, but God Himself. And we experience it. Everyone experiences it in their own way. So Prabhupada was proud. He was very proud of Krishna and his guru, and very proud of the process of bhakti, the inconceivable power packed within the bhakti marg. And he said, look, this new devotee, he's only 1 year. And you ask him, say, "What is your name? Who are you?" "My name is Krishna Das." "Who are you?" "I'm eternal servant of Krishna. I'm not this body. I'm not man, I'm not woman. I'm Krishna's eternal servant. I'm Aham Brahmasmi. I'm part and parcel of Krishna. Mamai Vamcho Jiva Loke Jiva Bhuta Sanatana. And my duty is to serve him day and night. Hari Bhav, Hare Krishna." And Prabhupada says, "See?" And he's been in the temple for 1 week, mostly eating prasad and sleeping. But he has so much understanding that he's not the body. So this is the power of bhakti. Automatically, the vairagya and gyan comes. The paths of karma and gyan and yoga, they're dry and troublesome. The definition of vairagya in the path of bhakti is most different from the general understanding of vairagya. Srila Prabhupada once defined vairagya. This is very interesting, because generally we think of vairagya as a self-denial or fasting or torturing the body in various ways by denying the body sleep deprivation, food deprivation, exposing the body to intense climatic, harsh climates. Go in the winter time. That's all right in May or June. Everybody wants to go to the Ganges. Everybody wants to go to Haridwar in June and bathe. But go in January and February when the wind is... We used to live in Rishikesh and the wind is whipping down the Ganga. It just takes the Ganga as its course and the wind just comes right down the Ganga path. And freezing cold wind in January and the water is freezing cold. And then go in there at that time and stay up to your neck all day. And you're supposed to go in at sunset and stay till sunrise because it's colder then. You can't sit, the sun... No, when the sun goes down, then you enter the Ganga up to your neck in January and see if you're still alive by sunrise. And this is austerity. And then someone might say, well, in the winter, if I'm in the Himalayas and I make four fires, a fire north, east, south, four different fires at 12 o'clock when the sun is in the top over my head, it's nice. It's winter time. If I sit in the middle of Panchagni Tapa, then it's nice, I feel good. But no, you have to go in June 10th, when it's hottest day in India. You have to go and sit in the five fires. So Prabhupada gave a very interesting definition of vairagya, or detachment. He said, which is quite interesting. He said in his own words, he said, vairagya or austerity, this is the trouble or the inconvenience a disciple undergoes or takes to fulfill the order of the spiritual master. A vairagi, or the renunciate, he subjects his body to great pain and trouble. But in doing this, he becomes body-centered. Isn't it? When you're fasting, what are you thinking about? Your body. Even we do. When we are our minimal fast of Nirjal Brat for Chovis Ganta and Ekadasi, we think, oh, I'm very hungry, oh, I'm very thirsty, my body hurts, my belly hurts, oh, I think, and if we're a little medically oriented, we think, oh, I'm having some pain in my left side, I think that's my pancreas. If you're having pain in your right side, you say, oh, I think my liver is some problem. Then your friend who's also a doctor, he says, no, actually you're having some muscle spasm in your large intestine. you're having a minor muscle spasm, peristaltic spasm, a spasm of the peristaltic muscles of your intestines because there's no food in there. And they're going like this. And then the other person says, listen, you guys, it's simple. We're hungry. So even we become thinking of the body when we're fasting. Or what to speak of that if they're doing something for 3 months all about the body. Or the trouble a devoted disciple undertakes to fulfill the order of the guru. So the guru might say, look, I want you to distribute 100 Bhagavad Gitas today for the marathon. You say, Guru Maharaj, but you know, after a few hours I feel so hungry. I said, eat. But we're only supposed to eat twice a day. Eat 5 times a day. But distribute 100 Gitas. So the trouble we take, we take the trouble. We're out from all day long, 24 hours. Maybe we don't sleep even, but eating is a little difficult to give up. This is trouble. We go here and there. But it's not, so this is the real thing. It's a very wonderful definition of renunciation. Because we're more inclined to inflict punishment on our bodies or do fasting than actually can take the trouble to carry out the order of the spiritual master. The spiritual master says, well, chant minimum 16 rounds, and if you can, chant 64 rounds a day. So I think I'd rather go on a... It's easier for me to go on a two-week grape juice fast. But try chanting 64 rounds a day, that order of the spiritual master, and how much trouble that will create in your mind and your determination powers and your mind control powers. It won't be so easy. So this Vairagi, he's subjecting his body to great pain and trouble. He becomes self-centered and hard-hearted. He doesn't care for others. He becomes devoid of compassion. The maximum attachment one attains is attachment to his own self. If one subjects his own self to so much trouble, what will he care for others? Austerity and Vairagya increase one's ego, and he becomes proud, and his heart becomes dry, and he becomes full of pride and anger. He thinks, oh, others are not performing austerities like me. I'm a big, big yogi. I'm standing on one leg for 10 years. Just see me. There are many stories about angry yogis cursing someone. Have you ever heard of the name Durvasa Muni? So someone may argue, if you don't cultivate jnana and vairagya, then how can you progress on the path of bhakti? We should always remember that bhakti causes bhakti. This is, it's so simple that we can't understand it. B equals B. Bhakti equals bhakti. Devotion equals devotion. Love equals love. Little love equals little love, which increases the little love to be a little more love. And a little more love offered to Krishna equals a little more love, which increases the little more love to become more love. So love increases love, increases love, increases love. And then the little love becomes more love, and the more love becomes maximum love. And the shraddha becomes ruchi, and the ruchi becomes asakti, and the asakti becomes bhava, and the bhava becomes prema. They're simply increments of increasing devotion, increments of increasing loving expression towards the Lord, starting with 5% to 10% to 100%. Always remember, only bhakti causes bhakti. Oh, how can I increase my love for Krishna? Chant more. Oh, this stupid answer, everything, chant more, chant more, chant more. I'm fed up with this chanting. Acha, then you're fed up with loving Krishna. Your loving progress stops right there. You're fed up, so then you can't eat anymore because you're fed up. Whatever bhakti one does will generate more bhakti. You chant 16 rounds and this results in purification. And you become increasingly attached to Krishna. And your knowledge and desire to chant more japa. 16 becomes 20 rounds, and then 30 and 32. It is said that bhakti sunyata, says bhakti sunyata bhakti. The philosophy of Srimad Bhagavatam and bhakti rasamrita sindhu is repeatedly telling that bhakti only comes from bhakti, not from anything else. Bhakti is a transcendental activity. If it comes from something else, then bhakti will also become material. Bhakti is transcendental. So it can't come from something else. It's not by manipulating the body you get bhakti. It's not by manipulating the mind you get bhakti. By manipulating the body you may do asanas and prepare yourself for pranayama, and by manipulating your breath you may be able to manipulate the mind or fix the mind where you want it. But again, those are simply adjustments of material elements, gross and subtle, moving the material energy this way or that way in an attempt to find something transcendental, hopefully. But in the bhakti marg, every inch or every second of practice is transcendental, because every second is connected with Krishna. But until one realizes Brahman through the Gyan Marg or Yoga Marg, then there's nothing Brahman about it until you realize Brahman. But bhakti from the first second, you say Hare Krishna, you're doing bhakti. And maybe some bhakti with some mix, we say Mishra, Mishra Bhakti. We don't say it's Mishra. You're doing Mishra. You're a mix. You're mixed up. When you say that in the material world, you're all mixed up with this material thing and that material thing. But when bhakti is mixed with something material, it's still bhakti, Mishra. It's bhakti, but it may be mixed, and then it becomes unadulterated and pure, and then it becomes Shuddha bhakti, Shuddha, pure bhakti. And we read that Puranas are telling, Purna Shuddha Nitya Mukto. I am pure. I am completely pure. Don't you understand that? And my name is completely pure also. And I am eternally liberated. And I am Mukunda. I give liberation to anyone who contacts me. And my name is eternally liberated. And my name gives liberation to anyone who contacts it. Do you understand that? Purna Shuddha Nitya Mukto. So this is told. As soon as we contact Krishna's name, Rupa Guna, then we're liberated. Then we're pure, and we become more and more pure. Everyone has that experience. And what happens when we stop? When we disconnect ourselves with Krishna, primarily we stop chanting. Then maybe some impurity comes to us. Sometimes it's said it's very difficult to chant Hare Krishna and at the same time be in Maya. Just think about it. I mean, because one thing has to stop. The bhakti, which is transcendental and takes you out of this material world, has to be put aside in order for you to enter into the material world and take part or enjoy the material energy. Say you're some brahmachari or sit on a bus and there's an empty seat next to you and you're chanting japa, then some college girl gets on a bus and there's nowhere to sit except next to you and... And she sits down, you're saying, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. And then she says, excuse me, are you from New York? Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. You know, if you're like a Haridas or something. You may stop your japa and say no, and especially if we're not that fixed in your japa. You may say, well, no, I'm from Boston. She says, oh, you look like you're from Boston. And then you start talking and you stop chanting. And she may even say, what's your cell phone number? and you don't say, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna Hare. You say, 9875, does that. Or then maybe you meet. And so it's pretty difficult. One party or the other would demand, you know, more attention, I would think. If it was a devotee girl, she might say, listen, you're chanting in a tenth of japa. So don't make offense, put that aside and be attentive to me, which is, of course, Maya. But I remember when we used to have brahmachari classes back in the 70s in Los Angeles, that class was given. They said, if your lips are always chanting Hare Krishna, you won't be able to get in trouble. So it's easier said than done, of course. Maya is very powerful, but not as powerful as Krishna. So if bhakti is transcendental, it must only come from a transcendental source, not from jnana and vairagya. Because the argument is, oh, without jnana and vairagya, how can you make progress in bhakti? This is the argument. So then we say, the rebuttal is that bhakti is not produced by anything material, it's transcendental. Its source is transcendental, so there's no material knowledge or material activity or any kind of material renunciation with the material body which will actually produce bhakti. It comes from a transcendental source. It doesn't come from jnana or vairagya. It's a law of cause and effect. Bhakti is only caused by bhakti. It's therefore not dependent on jnana or vairagya. There's confusion for those in the path of bhakti. They always mix bhakti with jnana and karma. That's why the very definition of bhakti, which is given by Rupa Goswami, what does he say? This is in the Mangala Charan of the book we're studying, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Anya Vilashita Shunyam. It's verse 11 of the book, which we gave years ago for 7 days class. Anya Vilashita Shunyam. Jnana Karma Dhyana Avritam. Avritam. Avritam means covering. Avahita. Avahita, avritam, means covering. Our bhakti, our devotion, should not have any coverings of jnana or vairagya. Or karma. Karma means vairagya. Vairagya comes under karma. Bhakti is a mood, a sentiment, feelings. Bhakti is bhav. One has consciousness of Krishna's sweet form and pastimes, his Madhurya Leela. There is further proof that bhakti arises from bhakti in Prahlad's teaching. This is a nice discussion if anyone wants to see. It's in 7th Canto, Chapter 9, verses 46 through 50, where Prahlad Maharaj is describing 10 different paths of self-realization or paths to liberation, including Mon Brata and many, many things that are done by the yogis and gyanis. But then he says that then he ends up with this Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu Smaranam. That's the conclusion, simply serving Krishna. And then actually in this particular session he says that Prahlad Maharaj, he taught the process of knowing Krishna. And by knowing Krishna, a devotee automatically attains jnana and knowledge of Krishna by adopting six limbs or six kinds of devotional service. So he mentions them. And then again he repeats this nine limbs later. But here he says, by offering prayers, by doing seva or working for the pleasure of Krishna, by worshipping the Lord, by remembering Krishna's lotus feet, by hearing about Krishna's pastimes, that's five, and by serving saintly people, that's six. Without performing these six activities, one can't become a Paramahamsa. This verse has no mention of jnana or vairagya. Prahlad clearly tells that only need to perform bhakti. There's no mention of jnana or vairagya. Krishna also tells Uddhava the same point, which is, we mentioned that already in our nectar devotion. Because oftentimes devotees, they get bewildered about all this. They always want to do some, because our nature is that we're kind of attracted to esoterica and fasting and mysticism, especially Western devotees. Indians are a little more simple. But Western devotees, they like mysticism and yoga and astrology and fasting and all kinds of these things. And just to sit and chant Hare Krishna is too plain and too ordinary, and you don't have to stand. If you have to do some difficult asana and then raise the kundalini by some special breathing, then you know something has to happen, a lightning flash or some kind of sea stars or something, then you can feel that something's happened. But the whole evolution of consciousness, I mean, the evolution of consciousness, which is happening in such a powerful and dramatic way by the practice of bhakti, is like the moving of a massive ice. I mean, consciousness is very vast. You can imagine it's universal. Our consciousness takes in the whole universe. And bhakti actually changes the entire content of our consciousness. Forget about mind and body. Mind and body are automatically included as minor limbs of consciousness. But it's so, because consciousness is the most subtle aspect of our beings. The chitta, the chaitana, the consciousness, the chit. We have a lot of understanding and awareness of our body and the workings of our physical body and senses, our eyes, our nose and ears. And we have some degree of understanding or familiarity with the workings of our mind, sankalpa, vikalpa, accepting, rejecting aspect of our minds and the chanchal nature of our minds, and then the discriminatory facility of our intelligence, the reasoning faculty, and discriminatory powers of intelligence. We use those and we utilize those in our everyday functioning. But then when it gets to consciousness, the level of consciousness, the innate awareness and identity of the very individual jiva, that becomes a frontier, as they say in science, frontiers of consciousness, or the vast frontier. And psychology articles and colleges and universities, they say that the last frontier, the frontier of consciousness, or what? Because they've studied the land and the sea and the body and other planets, and what about the vast realm of consciousness? And bhakti is all about consciousness. Jeto Dharpana Marjanam, purifying the consciousness. And so much is going on, but we don't really see it. It's like the movements of an ice mass or something. It's moving, you know, the ice, for example, a glacier, the movements of a glacier, the meteorologists and different scientists, well, geologists, I suppose, they study the Earth, so they measure the Arctic Pole or South Pole, and this vast glacier of ice, millions or thousands of miles long, and so they measure how much it's receding or expanding. Basically, it's receding, it's melting. And they say, oh, it went 1 millimeter in the last 10,000 years or whatever. It's a very slow movement. So consciousness is like the glacier. And bhakti is the melting point. So we think, often devotees, they say, they've been around 10 years and they say, or 15 years, oh, Maharaj, I've been in ISKCON for 10 years and I don't know what my complexion is, and I don't know what my siddhadeya is. I don't know my mandri srup. I'm a failure. I don't know whether I have two toe rings or one on my toes, you know, or do I have one on each foot? And they're really worried about that, the particularities of their unseen spiritual body. And unfelt. They have no feelings for their spiritual body and they can't see it. But they have an innate and uncontrollable curiosity to know it. And therefore everything I've done is not. Nothing's happened. I wasted all my time. I become so covered by this greed for higher understanding, which is okay, it's good. But it doesn't mean that nothing's happened in the last 10 years. Or 20 years. But it's very difficult to look in, to go to the local laboratory or health clinic and have a scan done of your consciousness and say, look, here's an ultrasound scan of your consciousness 10 years ago. Now look at your consciousness now. Wow, look at that. I've really gone a long way. Really, I was there at that 10 degree point. Yeah. Now you're at 40 degrees. Oh, that's very good. I didn't realize. So sometimes devotees feel some sadness. But this is due to laxity. When they're actually become lax in the basics of Krishna consciousness, of hearing and chanting, and the actual limbs of devotion, then they feel this ennui, or this desire to give up or quit, and nothing's happening, and woe is me, and I'm a failure. I think it's the process, it's not me. I invested in the wrong company, and my profits are not much, and everybody's going ahead of me, and what about little old me, and I'm not getting anywhere. But time tells all, and one is, because it's all transcendental, that's the very point we're making. Any limb of devotion, if you're connected with it, you're connected with Krishna, full. And if you're really connected with Krishna, mind and heart, then he'll say, listen, I want a deeper connection with you. In order to have a deeper connection with you, you need a spiritual body. And he'll give it. And then you can have that deeper internal connection. He will accept us to that level. He is the guardian. It's his party, not ours. It's his rasa dance, not ours. It's his leela, not ours. Remember, we're entering his leela for his pleasure, and according to his sweet will and his sweet time, when he calls us. Have you ever studied these rasa shastras? Do the gopis bust their way in? Yashoda, come on, what are you doing? You're in the, not even in Tatastha region. You're in Bahir Anga region. Come here, or come in the front. Mayapur, Vrindavan are none different. Text 254, and this is chapter 2, Eastern Division. Ruchim udvahata tatra janasya bhajane hari vishyeshu garishto pi raga prayo veliyate. Should a person attain ruchi or taste in the service of Krishna, then all his earthly attachments, however hard and difficult they are, shall soon melt away. If one has ruchi for worshipping Krishna, even though he may have strong material attractions, those attractions will mostly be destroyed during sadhana without resorting to any form of vairagya. So this is a very welcome note in the age of Kali, when people aren't too inclined towards austerity. Everybody wants to have a very simple and fast process to attain perfection, as everything is. They want to close one window and close the imperfection window and open the perfection window with one button, open a new window. So this is why Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came. He said, this is the Bhakti Yuga. You say Bhakti Yoga, but this is the Bhakti Yuga. And Bhakti is becoming more and more prominent everywhere in the world. Of course, the antithesis of Bhakti is Buddhism. So it's only natural that if one thing improves, the opposite has to improve. It's very interesting. So Buddhism is quite popular around the world. But that's simply that's for the agnostics. In any time period in the modern world, agnostics and atheists, they have to have some type of religious dogma or philosophy to hold on to. And the strain, the devotional strain, the worshippers of the personal God are always existing. Now the agnostics and the atheists, they're taking shelter of Buddhism, especially around the world. It's quite popular. But that simply, we see that as simply laying the stage for wholesale conversion to bhakti cult. Because on one side you have the Buddhists, which they're collecting all the agnostics and the atheists. Then the other side you have the devotional element, the worshippers of a personal God. And they're becoming more and more attracted to and centered on the idea of bhakti, as you may know or may not know. But around in America and Europe, everywhere they're having kirtan groups. Kirtan, we all know about kirtan, sankirtan. And there are even karmis that aren't even vegetarians, but they're good musicians, and they're giving up the path of ordinary music to take up kirtan as a music expression. And they're good singers, and they have good karma for, good Venus or whatever, Shukra Grahan. So they know how to attract people, and they're performers. And they go to coliseums, and people pay tickets. They pay $10 to have kirtan. There's some famous guy, his name is, I forget. Anyway, some guy, he just does kirtan. And then they interview him in music magazines. And what is your philosophy? Well, philosophy is just do kirtan and feel good. But as far as prema bhakti and serving Krishna, but people are actually gathering together, engaging. And I've read Jai Govinda, Jai Gopal, and mostly it's Nam Sankirtan. And Hare Krishna also. And it's becoming very, very popular. Extremely popular. I mean, thousands and thousands of Americans and Europeans are doing kirtan, not with the Krishnas. They still have long hair, everything, maybe follow one or half a principle or whatever. But it's kirtan, and it's the names of Bhagavan, Bhagavat Nam, which means there's bhakti there in some form. So unknowingly, the devotional sector, they're more and more centering around kirtan and around bhakti. And on the other side, Buddhism is increasing, and people follow Buddhism to a certain extent, and then they'll say, wait a minute, this is a dead end. It's like you can drive your car, and all of a sudden the road ends up in a dead end. You say, oh, wait a minute. And when you get to a dead end, when there's no right turn or left turn, what do you have to do? You have to turn your car around and go in a different direction. Because the direction you followed ended up nowhere. It ended up no further progress. So Buddhism has it doesn't progress infinitely. The end point comes very soon because that's the whole thing. It ends in nothing, nirvana. And the funny point is, it's an adopted Buddhism for the most part. For Westerners, it's an adopted philosophy. It's not inherent within them. Practically every single Western person in Europe and Russia, they all have genes for devotion. They're all like coming from thousand generations before being worshippers of Jesus and Allah or whatever. There's devotional genes. But by conditioning, by modern advertising and by whatever, people have adopted this idea of Buddhism. So when they run with it for a while, then something within them will say, this isn't it. And then they'll say, where to go? And then they'll say, oh, there's kirtan. Everywhere there's kirtan. There's only basically two choices in the world right now. It's shaping up like this. There's kirtan and there's Buddhism. So a lot of the kirtan, of course, is not the pure kirtan. It's not Mahaprabhu kirtan. It's just concocted kirtan. But Krishna's name is there. Sanket Nam, Hela Nam, all these types of Nam, Namavas. And they're engaging. They don't know. They just get together. Jai Gopal, Jai Govinda. thousand people in Coliseums chanting in kirtan. Chicago, New York, L.A. And now you go down to the local Hare Krishna temple where they're chanting pure kirtan. Two guys that have been coming for 49 years to the temple. And they're in the evening kirtan. But down the street, people are paying $10, $15, $25 to go to the kirtan. And it's free in any temple. So when this taste will come, and they'll destroy everything, this simple process. So Jiva gives a commentary, Vairagya or detachment hardens the heart of the beginner in the path of yoga and bhakti, and such Vairagya has already been discarded. Does it then follow that sense enjoyments have been prescribed for him? If so, then attachment for Krishna becomes an impossibility for one whose heart is preoccupied with attachment to worldly objects of sense enjoyment. Can anybody achieve objects which are in the West when one walks to the East? It's not possible. The Jiva Goswami explains the very fact that if one has some ruchi or taste for bhakti, this indicates that he has non-attachment to material, earthly pleasures. Therefore, it becomes unnecessary for him to undergo the heart-hardening hardships of vairagya or asceticism. Because if a person has attained ruchi for bhakti, whatever attachments may be still lingering him, they will spontaneously melt away and he'll be completely wiped out when bhakti develops in depth and steadiness. So, of course, Ruchi is being talked about here. It's called Ruchi Abhas. It's not the specific stage of devotion. Anartha Nivritti, then Nishta, then Ruchi. But all along the line, in the introduction to Nectar Devotion, Prabhupada explains how every endeavor is inspired by and maintained by and propelled by what is called Ras, the taste. Ras means a taste or flavor. Prabhupada said there's a Ras and fighting, if someone's fighting with someone, they get some pleasure, some vira ras, one of the secondary rasas, or the taste of victory. This ras is what, he said, it drives a man on. He said, just like in the Nectar Devotion introduction, Prabhupada said, in the family man, he is working very hard for his family and maintaining his wife and children, but he's only able to do that day after day work because he's getting some taste of being the provider, being the supporter, and then the reciprocation with the wife, and then the children, and the whole thing put together, it's being sustained because there's something real that, at least in his mind, he's experiencing something real that's driving him forward. Otherwise, how could one get up every day, go to work, drive 2 hours in the commute in the car in the traffic, or 2 hours, and 2 hours coming back? So there's some type, Prabhupada says there's a rasa. And the same thing with a devotee. And that's how we preach. We say you try devotion, try bhakti, chanting, etc. And if you get no experience and no taste and no higher, satisfaction within yourself, then forget it, drop it. Don't go forward. That's how I preach. I meet new people, I say try it. Try chanting for 10 minutes a day. See if something happens. Try it for 1 month. And then first you restrain yourself, be a vegetarian. Try chanting for 10 minutes a day and read one page of Bhagavad Gita. But generally, we find that a lot of people, it sticks, it works, something happens. I mean, all of us sitting here, nothing's happening. We're all, as the, sometimes people accuse, we're all brainwashed. Everyone sitting here has a degree from college or one or two degrees or more. Everyone's worked professionally, born in wealthy families, have good karma. We're all so brainwashed and stupid. I can't discriminate what's real and what's actually meaningful and satisfactory to us. Someone's forcing us to be here? Hardly. And some devotees are coming from 10,000 miles away from their house to live in India. Of course, on a day like this, no one could complain. But not every day is like this. You can count on your fingers how many days are like this. So that's something happening. So these are the spiritual practices in the way of bhakti. They create detachment for worldly objects, and they also awaken gyan, knowledge of one's own true self and of the Lord. So of course the acharyas, commentators in this verse, which Rupa Goswami is giving in the context of sadhana, because sadhana bhakti, it goes all the way to bhava. So bhava, of course, before bhava bhakti is asakti and ruchi. So when this word here is ruchi, then although the general flow is it's just the taste that comes from practicing bhakti in the beginning, some acharyas in the comments are saying, he says ruchi, when one attains ruchi, which means after nishta, when he actually comes to that platform ruchi, then automatically and with any lingering attachments he has for worldly pleasure, they simply melt away, they simply boil away, or they just vaporize. There's just some, Vishwanath is saying one thing in Mukunda Das Goswami. And then in the next stage, after ruchi comes asakti, which is attachment for the Lord, and all mundane attractions are completely removed from the heart. And Vishwanath says, this is the commentaries, he says, ruchi in this shloka means shraddha, that is aroused in the heart after one, that's what I was speaking of, which is aroused in the heart after one is taken to the path of bhakti. Even if there's any lingering attachment for worldly pleasure, after one has entered the path of bhakti, no great attention need to be paid to it, because this lingering attachment for worldliness will be completely removed from the heart when the flower of bhakti will fully bloom. I think anyone that's been in Krishna consciousness for a few years or longer can testify to the fact that what attachments we had when we first started may be very strong. But as the days and months and years go by, that fire of those attractions diminishes more and more. And it's like, oh yeah, I remember I used to have some attraction for that. And sometimes a fleeting memory of that may come, or some reminder, and then, or even the very object that you're attached to may present itself right under your nose. And then you say, oh, no thank you. No, I'm not interested. Thank you. Goodbye. It can be the most powerful attraction that the material world has to offer. But the devotee, even after a year or two, he may say, no thanks. It should have come a few years ago. I could have taken you up on it. But now it's too late. There's some kind of bhaktis come inside and danced in my mind, so I don't have much interest. We remember after 3 or 4 years of Sankirtan, then we'd go door to door, and they would have 4 or 5 devotees and have these apartment houses all around. They'd say, you take that apartment house, you take that one. And you could spend an hour all day up, going up and down the floors and selling books. And you're by yourself on Saturday afternoon because the airport would be slow. So you go to the apartment houses, usually work at the airport. And people don't work on Saturday in America. So you show up there about 10 or 11 o'clock, knock on a door with your bhagavatams in your bag, and there's a little hole in the door, and something, you don't know what's behind the hole, someone looks out, and they say, what do you want? I say, we're just yoga students, we're showing some interesting books from India, or whatever, some line, or whatever. And show me your books. And they say, well, actually, you know, this is Bhagavatam. You know, so there's many opportunities for forgetting Krishna on the path of devotion. But if someone has a little bit of footing in the devotional sphere, then he says, no, come in, you must be thirsty or hungry, come in. And I say, not hungry or thirsty for you. Let's put it that way. So then you just get right to the point. You know, if you're really staunch, you'll actually even try to sell them a Bhagavatam at the door. At the door. Same way, this is a really interesting book about yoga. The staff, you want, it's $10. No, don't think. Okay, bye. And you go out like that because you never know what's going to happen when they open the door. And then you go back to your Sankirtan leader and say, can I stay at the temple? Or can somebody go with me? It's a little austere going door to door when you're 24 years old. And you know. So this is... But each devotee in his own way, in his own time and place, he'll have the experience of how Bhakti Devi is embracing his heart in such a warm and intimate way that he doesn't really feel much attraction for Maya Devi. Because there's two Devis you can embrace in this world. You can embrace Bhakti Devi or Maya Devi. Or be embraced by Bhakti Devi or be embraced by Maya Devi. Because the Purusha is one and everything else is female. The Purusha is only Krishna. So before you get to embrace Krishna, you have to go through a secretary. Krishna's secretary in the material world is Maya Devi. And Krishna's secretary in the spiritual world is Bhakti Devi. And she's actually the expansion of Radharani. So Bhakti Devi, if you pass the secretary of Maya Devi, then she says, well, listen, I'll give you an appointment with Bhakti Devi. And then you meet Bhakti Devi, and then she takes notes and shorthand and monitors you for some time. And she says, actually, I would like to introduce you to my boss. And my boss is Srimati Radharani, Radhika Devi. And then that's when your life of pure devotion begins, under the shelter of Radharani and her feet, Radhadasyam. So it's a Devi parampara, from Maya Devi to Bhakti Devi to Radha Devi, isn't it? And there's no, you can't bribe these secretaries, that's the problem. These are not Indian politicians. They can, or even Indian professors, you can bribe your way to success. Pass the exam. You can't go to Maya Devi and say, listen, I'll give you a big chunk of money. Just let me out of this material world. And she said, no, I'll take you for a ride. I'll even take you through different planetary systems and I'll offer you different opulences and positions as you go. I'll take you on a tour, a guided tour of the whole creation. And we can stop over in different planets and you can be the lord and master of those different planets. Maya Devi's agent is Mukti Devi. So Mukti Devi says, why don't you stay here in Swarga and have a good time? Oh yeah, thanks, that looks nice. And then if you say, no, what's the next stop? Oh, okay, you don't want this stopover, get in. Then you go to, well, how about Tibet? You want to have mystic powers, stay here and fly around Tapaloka. No, I don't want a set of wings. And then you get in again, what's the next stop? And it's, well, the next stop is, Bhakti Devi's going to take over now. And then you can enter Vaikuntha.